The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, viewers and listeners. Michael Scott, guest hosting for Robin Benton. This is Race Treaty, the 29th of January, 2016, Black Talk Radio. And today we will be talking about the members of the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, United Nations, the Special Procedures of the Human Rights Council, and the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights initial report of their UN, of the U.S. official visit, which was January 19th through 29th. So today we assembled at the UN Information Center in Washington, D.C. on K Street, and the Honorable Chairperson Muriel Fanon Mendez France, that's France Fanon's daughter, for all those that are Fanon fans and readers, and two other commissioners gave a statement, which I'm going to start the show by reading, as soon as I thank Robin Benton for the opportunity, Stephanie Franklin of the Franklin Law Group, who was our anchor institution in Baltimore, Ajim Dike of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and Onaji Muid, who hosted the last show that we had this conversation on. And I guess I should introduce myself. My name is Michael Scott. I'm a long time Maryland resident from Baltimore, really from Sandy Spring, Maryland. And I run Equity Matters, founder and chief equity officer. And we are committed, in short, to equity in all policy. So with that, I'd like to just get started at length by reading this lengthy statement so that you can have a flavor for what happened today and on their visit. It was a live stream that should be available on the bottom of the webpage here. There's a link. I'm not quite sure how the quality is, so I'm just going to read this rather lengthy 14-page report, stopping perhaps to give some color commentary and certainly afterwards. And feel free to call in. I think we can give that number later. So there was a lot of press there, and a number of civil society members who had given testimony both in Washington, Chicago, Baltimore. I don't think anyone from Mississippi came. The Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent thanks the government of the United States of America for its invitation to visit the country from 19 to 29 January 2016 and for its cooperation. This visit is a follow-up to the 2010 visit of the WGEPAD, and that's the Working Group of People of Experts of Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, and includes other cities. This visit is a follow-up to that 2010 visit and includes other cities. We thank in particular the Department of State for arranging the visit and the local authorities who met with the working group during our visit to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Jackson, Mississippi, Chicago, and New York City. And I'm going to pause there and say that as a civil society member running a small but growing community-based organization, one of our duties that we talked about, and there will be follow-up work in organizing and strategy after this and ongoing, is to make sure that we engage with our local authorities to get a formal report out of what the UN and those local authorities talked talk about what they discussed and what they are resolved to do. So that's an action point for folks in those cities. To continue, we would like to give special thanks to the hundreds of civil society representative organizations, lawyers, and individuals from the African American community for sharing their concerns and recommendations with our delegation. We also thank numerous human rights defenders and activists who reached out to us from other parts of the country that we could not visit. The working group regrets that it did not receive access according to the terms of reference for special procedure mandate holders to visit Mississippi State Penitentiary Parchment, infamous Parchment Penitentiary in Mississippi. It also regrets that it was not possible to meet with all of the high-level state and local-level authorities requested. The views expressed in this statement are of a preliminary nature. Our findings and recommendations will be presented in our mission report to the United Nations Human Rights Council in September 2016. And I'll pause there and say, firstly need to admit I'm appreciative of this opportunity because I'm a relative newbie to the formal procedures of U.S. human rights. My family's been doing this work for centuries as we live in the center of the Underground Railroad in Central Maryland at Sandy Spring. But I'm new to this particular thing. But what I have gleaned and understood from some of the veterans is that this is a process. It's not exactly a diplomatic process. It's not exactly a legal process, but it's a process. So they will issue their report. The U.S. will have a chance to respond, and then they will issue a final report. At which point the various treaties that have been signed need to be complied with. Of course, there is no legal mandate, and we'll get to that, but this is an opportunity for civil society to hold the U.S. Government and at all levels accountable for U.S. human rights mandates. And so let's pick up there. So during the visit, the working group assessed the situation of African Americans and people of African descent and gathered information on the forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, Afrophobia, and related intolerance that they face. We studied the official measures and mechanisms taken to prevent structural racial discrimination and protect victims of racism and hate crimes, as well as responses to multiple forms of discrimination. The visit focused on both good practices and challenges faced in realizing their human rights. We welcome the work of the Civil Rights Centers in all government departments and the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission that implement the civil rights legislation through investigation of complaints, litigation, issuance of guidance and remedies, including compensation. We're going to come back to that point. And Professor Elder Vanilla Randall at a later time during the show. We also acknowledge the work of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division regarding access to justice, investigations of excessive use of force by the police, and patterns of discrimination. We welcome the recent steps taken by the government to reform the criminal justice system and combat racial discrimination and disparities through the following initiatives: the Fair Sentencing Act, the Justice Department's Smart on Crime Initiative, the report and recommendations of the Task Force on 21st Century Policing to strengthen community police relationships across the country, the new guidance for federal law enforcement agencies regarding the use of race, ethnicity, gender, national origin, religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity, the guidance for consideration of arrests and conviction records in employment decisions under the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. During our visit, the government adopted an executive order to reduce the use of solitary confinement at the federal level by prohibiting solitary confinement of juveniles, diverting inmates with serious mental health illness to alternative forms of housing, and establishing that inmates should be housed in the least restrictive setting among other issues. These changes are part of a larger effort to pass criminal justice reforms now pending in Congress. The White House initiatives such as My Brother's Keeper and on educational excellence for African Americans, aimed at addressing opportunity gaps and improving educational outcomes for African Americans. The new report from the Charles Colson Task Force on Federal Corrections that punitive mandatory sentences for drug crimes represents the primary driver for prison overcrowding. We welcome the abolition of the death penalty in three additional states since the working group visit to the U.S. in 2010, as this form of inhumane punishment is disproportionately used against African Americans. One of the most important developments in the area of health has been the adoption of the Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act, which has allowed 2.3 million African American adults to gain medical health insurance. The working group was also informed about some positive steps at the state level. In New York, we welcome measures that prohibit employers from asking about criminal history until an employee is hired, and that make possible the issuance of municipal identification cards for undocumented immigrants, and that create a policy of desk appearance tickets for certain offenders as an alternative to imprisonment for a misdemeanor offense. We also note the decision to end the policy of stop and frisk. In Chicago, we welcome the steps taken to combat the home foreclosure crisis that had especially impacted African Americans. We also welcome the measures taken by the mayor to foster accountability in the police department following the Laquan McDonald's case. I will reserve comment. Continuing, the U.S. has a growing human rights movement which has successfully advocated for social change. Following the epidemic of racial violence by the police, civil society networks calling for justice together with other activists are strongly advocating for legal and policy reforms and community control over policing and other areas which directly affect African Americans. You better bet it. Despite the positive measures referred to above, the working group is extremely concerned about the human rights situation of African Americans. The colonial history, the legacy of enslavement, racial subordination and segregation, racial terrorism, and racial inequality in the United States remains a serious challenge, as there has been no real commitment to reparations and to truth and reconciliation for people of African descent. Despite the substantial changes since the end of the enforcement of Jim Crow and the fight for civil rights, ideology ensuring the domination of one group over another continues to negatively impact the civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights of African Americans today. The dangerous ideology of white supremacy inhibits social cohesion amongst the U.S. population. Lynching was a form of racial terrorism that has contributed to a legacy of racial inequality that the U.S. must address. Thousands of people of African descent were killed in violent public acts of racial control and domination, and the perpetrators were never held accountable. Contemporary police killings and the trauma it creates are reminiscent of the racial terror lynching of the past. Impunity for state violence has resulted in the current human rights crises and must be addressed as a matter of urgency. Racial bias and disparities in the criminal justice system, mass incarceration, and the tough on crime policies has disproportionately impacted African Americans. Mandatory minimum sentencing, disproportionate punishment of African Americans, including the death penalty, are all of grave concern. During this country visit, The experts observed the excessive control and supervision targeting all levels of their life. This control, since September 2001, has been reinforced by the introduction of the Patriot Act. We heard testimonies from African Americans based on their experience that people of African descent are treated by the state as a dangerous criminal group and face a presumption of guilt rather than innocence. Guilty until proven innocent. The state is also not acting with due diligence to protect the rights of African American communities, as evidenced by the lack of gun control and stand your ground laws, among others. Hate crime groups, including white supremacist terror groups, are still active in the U.S., targeting the black community, as was seen in the attack at the church in Charleston in 2015. The Confederate flag is considered as a symbol of hate for many African Americans, and they have led campaigns to have it removed. However, it is still used by some local authorities. The persistent gap in almost all the human development indicators, such as life expectancy, income and wealth, level of education, and even food security among African Americans and the rest of the U.S. population, reflects the level of structural discrimination that creates de facto barriers for people of African descent to fully exercise their human rights. Disparities in the enforcement of policies can be found in the different approaches adopted by states to address issues such as racial profiling, the presence of police in schools, the criminalization of homelessness, the limitations on the use of lethal force by law enforcement officials, the use of solitary confinement, and the trial of juvenile offenders, among others. The working group is concerned about the alarming levels of policy brutality and excessive use of lethal force by law enforcement officials committed with impunity. In addition to the most recent and well-known cases of killings of unarmed African Americans, such as the cases of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, and Laquan McDonald. I want to add to that Sandra Bland. The working group also received information, and many others say their names. The working group also received information about many other similar cases. The working group met with a considerable number of relatives of African Americans killed by police that are still seeking justice for their loved ones, including Tyron West, Tyron Lewis, Jonathan Sanders, Oscar Grant, Tony Robinson, Marlon Brown, India Cager, Ronald Johnson, Muhammad Ba, and Alonzo Smith. Despite some efforts made by the Department of Justice, there is still a lack of an official national system to track killings committed by law enforcement officials. I'm going to pause there and say that one of our allies at Harvard, Nancy Krieger, from a public health vantage point, which I will also talk about once I finish reading the statement, has called for that to be taken up by public health local authorities and at other levels, regional and national levels, because of the epidemic nature of police killings and shootings, and that it should be recorded as such, and that they have the authority to do so. That is not yet taken full traction. Back to the statement. Despite efforts made by the Department of Justice, there's still a lack of an official national system to track killings committed by law enforcement officials. Unofficial sources, such as the Washington Post and the Guardian, identified between 38 and 75 cases of unarmed African Americans killed by the police in 2015. I would add there's another set of civil society groups that are also doing the counting as well. However, the working group is deeply concerned about the low number of cases where police officers have been held accountable. The working group identified that the lack of initial investigations conducted by independent and external bodies from police departments, the wide discretion of attorney generals to determine when and how to present charges, and the state and county regulation that are not, I repeat, the state and county regulation that are not in line with international standards on the use of the force and firearm, on the use of force and firearms. These are some of the main barriers to police accountability. Racial profiling is a rampant practice and seriously damages the trust which African Americans have in relation to law enforcement officials. Okay. Some media portray African Americans as criminals, and this negatively impacts on the perception which the American society in general has in relation to African Americans. With 2.3 million people incarcerated and 4.8 million on parole or probation, mass incarceration has a disproportionately has had a disproportionately impact, a negative impact on people of African descent. The Bureau of Justice Statistics in 2014 shows that 36% of the sentenced state and federal prisoners are African American. One in three African American men will go to prison or jail if current trends continue. African American women are also increasingly being targeted by the criminal justice system. The cost of mass incarceration practices must be measured in human lives, and particularly the generations of young black people who serve long prison sentences and are lost to their family members and communities, to their families and communities. We also heard how mass incarceration of black men and women has a devastating effect on their children. We expressed deep concern on the continued existence of the death penalty in 31 states and at the federal level. African Americans represent 41.7% of death row population. Let me repeat that. African Americans represent 41.7% of death row population. And out of 28 inmates executed in 2015, 10 were African American. State laws that establish mandatory minimum sentences and zero tolerance policies have been applied with racial bias. Thousands of young African Americans have been placed in detention centers without addressing the root causes of crime or guaranteeing better security to their communities, nor have they been offered effective rehabilitation. The working group is concerned about inadequate conditions of detention and in accessing quality health care, including for mental health. Reportedly, inmates were either misdiagnosed or over-medicated. I might add, so are some of our children in schools. African American communities highlighted that the privatization of prisons might tend to privilege the earning of profits by sacrificing adequate detention conditions. We are also concerned about the criminalization of poverty, which disproportionately affects African Americans. There has been an increase in imprisonment of people for minor offenses and those who are unable to pay debts due to an increase in fines and fees. They are detained in debtor prisons and made to work off their debts. As the Justice Department has shown in the investigation of the Ferguson Police Department, we call that police tearing, in other counties, the imposition of fines is a way to secure revenues than a public security issue. Again, police security. This creates numerous problems for the individual and family. There is also an excessive punishment of poor children for minor offenses. The devastating impact of the war on drugs has led to mass incarceration and is compared to enslavement due to exploitation and dehumanization of African Americans. I'm going to pause there. Our work started doing Cradle to College Pipeline exactly a decade ago. It was well before the new Jim Crow Michelle Alexander, but we were thrilled that such a clear voice and champion emerged. And I would recommend, if you all have not read The New Jim Crow, to pick it up. But I would also like to add that an interesting companion book and text to consider is The Market Forces Driving That, 000, spelled out, by Robert Saviano. Talks about narcotics and the narco markets being the last or the most prevalent form of pure market capitalism. And he names names and describes the construction of cartels all over the world as driving, as a driving force from which mass incarceration is then impacting our community. I digress. Back to the reading. While noting the recent executive order on solitary confinement, we remain concerned about its use in prisons, juvenile detention centers, and foster care at both federal and state levels. We are particularly concerned about its negative impact on children. People that serve their time in prison continue to be stigmatized when they are released, when they come home, I might add. Their criminal records impede them from finding a job and getting adequate housing or accessing social programs and voting. Some reentry programs are not well funded and are not present countrywide. We are concerned about the underage prosecution of children as adults in the USA. Children are detained in adult jails and prisons, putting them at risk of sexual assault and abuse. These practices are a violation of children's human rights and should be eliminated. Juveniles should be treated as juveniles, no matter what crime they are alleged to have committed, and must be held in a juvenile facility. The working group was also concerned that voter ID laws with increased identification requirements in several states serve to discriminate minorities such as African Americans, contrary to the spirit of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The cumulative impact of racially motivated discrimination faced by African Americans in the enjoyment of their right to education, health, housing, and employment, among other economic, social, cultural, and environmental rights, has had serious consequences for their overall well-being. Racial discrimination continues to be systemic and rooted in an economic model that denies development to the poorest African American communities. More than 10 million, 26% of African Americans remain mired in poverty, and almost half of them, 12%, live in what is known as deep poverty. The working group is particularly concerned about the fact that 48% of the households headed by African American women live under the poverty line. The working group noted that a number of factors contributed to the disparities faced by African Americans in the realization of the right to health, including access to health insurance coverage, lack of access to preventive services and care, and lack of diversity and cultural competency of the care. While the implementation of the Affordable Care Act has led to a 17.6 million additional people getting health insurance coverage, states with some of the widest health disparities in the country have rejected Medicaid expansion, one of the main tools to cover the uninsured. 9 out of 10 people who fall into the coverage gap live in the South, and Black adults are more likely than any other racial group to be affected. The impact of social determinants, that's our stuff, such as access to quality and healthy housing conditions, lack of education and employment, transportation barriers, also continue to serve as barriers to the full enjoyment of the right to health. I'm just going to pause there and put a little word from your host that the data suggests that the great majority of avertable death is caused by social determinants. People think it's genetics or access to care, and that only really represents about 70%. 40 to 70 is really around where you live, work, and play, the social determinants of health. I'm going to add another thing for your listening pleasure. Health equity, while a process and a verb, as I would say, is the assurance of the conditions for optimal health for all people. Assurance being one of three core functions of public health. Measurement and policy development are the other two. But achieving health equity requires valuing all individuals and populations equally, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices. Say that again. Recognizing and rectifying historical injustices and providing resources according to need. Health disparities will be eliminated when health equity is achieved. I don't know if we need to take a break, but I can pause if we do.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
Welcome back. Michael Scott, Equity Matters, thankfully sitting in as a guest host for Robin Benton. Thanks again to Stephanie Franklin, the Franklin Law Group, Agent DJ of the U.S. Human Rights Network, the Honorable Muriel Fanon Mendez France, the chairperson of the members of the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent under the special procedures of the Human Rights Councils of the United Nations in the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Geneva, Switzerland, for their initial report and findings in the press conference, statement to the media by the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent at the conclusion of its official visit to the U.S. January 19-29, 2016. So I'll continue. We left off taking a break talking about health. And so I wanted to make a little comment about our work at Equity Matters and the collaborators for Health Equity nationally. We'll come back to that if we have time. The working group learned that African Americans have limited access to food variety, including healthy food, as they are concentrated in poor neighborhoods with food outlets selling unhealthy and even expired food. African Americans have the highest rates of obesity, which is linked to food deserts. Racial discrimination impedes the ability of black women to maintain overall good health, control their sexuality and reproduction, survive pregnancy and childbirth, and parent their children. Black women in the U.S. die from pregnancy-related complications at a rate 3 to 4 times higher than white women. I will also add that they have the health outcomes. Black women with PhDs and advanced degrees have the health outcomes from a more infant mortality standpoint of white women who have dropped out of high school. Another interesting social determinant health fact. And anyway, continuing. We were informed that across the country there are police in the schools arresting children for minor offenses. The police have authority to detain, frisk, and arrest children in school. Say that again. The police have authority to detain, frisk, and arrest children in school. Zero tolerance policies and heavy-handed efforts to increase security in schools have led to excessive penalization and harassment of African American children through racial profiling. African American children are more likely to face harsh disciplinary measures than white children. This phenomenon has been sadly described as the school-to-prison pipeline. One might have amended it to call it the womb-to-prison pipeline, and now we need a cradle-to-career pipeline. I digress. The working group was concerned by the underfunding and closure of schools that are particularly in poor neighborhoods with significant African American populations. We were concerned to learn that there are threats to close the Chicago State University, a historically black university. In school curricula, the historical facts concerning the period of colonization and enslavement are not sufficiently covered in all schools. This history, crucial in the organization of the current American society, is taught differently by states and fails to adequately address the root causes of racial inequality and injustice. And I will add that, let me finish. Consequently, this contributes to the structural invisibility of African Americans. Chairperson Fanon Mendez France also commented on colonization of information. Which is one of her specialties. We have received, and that was during the question and answer session, we have received information about de facto segregation in schools. Segregation appears to be nurtured by a culture of insufficient acknowledgement of the history of enslavement and the Jim Crow law. There is also a lack of attention to the matter of reparatory justice for enslavement and its effects. We are concerned about the persistence of a de facto residential segregation in many of the metropolitan areas in the U.S. A series of maps generated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development shows not only stark levels of concentration of African-American families in low-income neighborhoods and districts, but also the correlation between racial segregation and disparities in access to health, education, and even access to adequate food among them and the white population. I've just got to chime in that we know that the zip code is the greatest determinant of your life expectancy. And when you control, which is not all there, this is Equity Matters and National Collaborative for Health Equity, when you control for poverty among all kids, it is only white kids who live in low concentrations of poverty and where they can essentially blend into privilege. Whereas the higher the percentage of poverty, the darker it gets in terms of black and brown and people of color. I digress. The zip code can determine to some extent the future development of young African Americans. People from black poor neighborhoods are more likely to face lower education achievements, more exposure to violence and crime, a tense interaction with the police, which leads to vigilance and allostatic load, chronic stress, I digress, less employment opportunities, environmental degradation, and low life expectancy rates as well. In many cities, African Americans are facing a housing crisis in which people are not able to pay their rents or mortgages, and even less to purchase a new house. In addition, the working group was informed about the destruction of public housing in some cities. At the same time, public funding for new houses appears insufficient to meet the demands of need in new housing. The working group was informed that African Americans are more likely than white people with similar borrowing profiles to be victims of predatory lending and to receive higher cost loans. In addition, the process of gentrification has a heavy impact on African Americans who are being displaced from city centers under the argument of the need for new investment and development. In particular, the working group was alarmed by incidents of eviction, demolition, and conversion of very farm public housing in Washington, D.C. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in 2015, of over 500,000 homeless people in the U.S., African Americans constituted 40.4%. They also constituted 30.4% of the homeless people that were unsheltered. So despite the recovery of the U.S. economy, the impact of the 2008-2009 economic recession had on African Americans is still very present. The unemployment rate among African Americans is twice the national unemployment rate. The working group is especially concerned about the level of unemployment among young African Americans without a high school degree. In 2014, the annual income for African Americans was almost half the income of white Americans who are not Hispanic. People of African descent continue to be underrepresented in higher level working positions. In 2013, they only represented the 7% of the senior level employers. Instead, their participation on temporary jobs with lesser security and lower salaries has been on the increase in recent years. Nearly 500,000 African Americans earn the minimum wage, shoot for 15 or more. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, continued to receive more than 30,000 complaints a year concerning racial discrimination. The highest polluting industrial facilities across a range of sectors, from farming, mining, to manufacturing, are more likely to be situated in poor and minority neighborhoods, including those people of African descent. For instance, we are concerned about the possible health risks to people of African descent on account of the incinerator project in Curtis Bay, Baltimore, Maryland, and the lead contaminated water in Flint, Michigan. African American communities are calling for environmental justice as they are concerned that they are disproportionately exposed to environmental hazards impacting their health and standard of living. We also studied intersectionality of the different forms of discrimination and heard experiences of discrimination based on skin color, ethnicity, religion, socioeconomic status, sex, and gender identity. In particular, we are concerned by the increasing level of violence and murders of transgendered women. The complexity of the organization of the legal system, with the independence of federal, state, county, and tribal jurisdiction, and the lack of direct applicability of international human rights law and federal law and policy, creates gaps that impacts deeply on the human rights of African Americans. The working group acknowledges that the civil rights federal legislation put in place in the 60s and the 70s had a positive impact addressing individual and even institutional cases of racial discrimination. However, hearing the testimonies of African American communities in different parts of the country, the working group is concerned about how civil rights laws implementation is not being sufficiently effective to overcome and transform the structural racial discrimination against African Americans. The working group is concerned that African Americans do not have the possibility to bring their cases or individual complaints to regional and international bodies when they have exhausted all domestic remedies at the state and federal level, as they are not party to the protocols which would otherwise allow them to bring complaints. Furthermore, international human rights treaties cannot be invoked in national courts, as there is no enabling legislation, and they have been declared non-self-executed. So here are the recommendations of the working group. The following recommendations are intended to assist the United States of America in its efforts to combat all forms of racism, racial discrimination, Afrophobia, xenophobia, and related intolerance. The working group reiterates the following recommendation made after its visit to the United States in 2010. Establish a national human rights commission in accordance with the Paris principles. The government should establish within this body a specific division to monitor the human rights of African Americans. In addition to the above, the working group urges the government of the United States to consider the ratification of the core international human rights treaties to which the United States is still not a party. I repeat that. The ratification of the core international human rights treaties to which the United States is still not a party, with a view to remove any gaps in the protection and full enjoyment of rights therein. It also encourages the USA to ratify regional human rights treaties as well as review reservations related to the treaties it has signed or ratified. Federal and state laws should be adopted incorporating the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and other international human rights treaties. There is a profound need to acknowledge that the transatlantic slave trade, repeat that. There is a profound need to acknowledge that the transatlantic slave trade was a crime against humanity, and among the major sources and manifestations of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance, and that Africans and people of African descent were victims of these acts and continue to be victims of their consequences. Past injustices and crimes against African Americans need to be addressed with reparatory justice. Monuments, memorials, and markers should be erected to facilitate this important public dialogue. Education must be accompanied by acts of reconciliation, which are needed to overcome acts of racial bigotry and legacies of injustice. To accelerate the process of desegregation, federal and state legislation should be passed, recognizing the experience of enslavement. During the International Decade for People of African Descent, public forums or hearings should be held with African American communities to enter into a constructive and open dialogue in which organizations, social movements have access to share experiences and to engage with the policymakers and institutions and local state and federal government on ways to address the current crisis. We also encourage Congress to pass H.R. 40, Commission to Study Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act, establishing the commission to examine slavery and discrimination in the colonies and the United States from 1619 to the present and recommend appropriate remedies. We encourage the U.S. government to elaborate a national action plan for racial justice to fully implement the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, CERD, or ICERD as some call it, and comprehensively address racism affecting African Americans. The government should increase engagement with human rights organizations and civil society at large with an aim to implement the universal periodic review recommendations made to and accepted by the USA. And I would add, we need to help in strengthening civil society here. I digress. Back there. We urge the government to ensure that recent policies undertaken to address racial disparities will be further implemented at the federal and state levels. The working group urges Congress to expedite the passing of all pending criminal justice reform bills, including the End Racial Profiling Act, the Second Chance Reauthorization Act, and welcomes the bipartisan support for the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, which, among other things, proposes to drastically reduce the use of mandatory minimum sentences. In imposing the sentence, the welfare of the family of the accused should be taken into account, with particular attention to the best interests of the child. I think that bears reading again. In imposing the sentence, the welfare of the family, the black family, of the accused should be taken into account with particular attention to the best interests of the child. I don't know if that will really be the case so far. Appropriate measures should be adopted to prevent excessive bail. Alternatives to detention should also be explored. Community policing strategies should be developed to give the community control of the police, which are there to protect and serve them. It is suggested to have a board that would elect police officers they want playing this important role in their communities. Love that. Before non-payment of a court fine or fee is treated as civil contempt of court or as a civil contempt of court charge, it must first be determined whether the individual has the ability to pay. Imprisonment should not be offered as a way of paying off the debt. If the debt cannot be paid, the fee should not be levied. We also recommend that part of the prison reform processes and policies include specific policies to address increasing rates of incarceration of African American women. Solitary confinement should be banned absolutely for being in violation of international human rights law standards, particularly those found in the United Nations Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, and the United Nations Standard Minimum Rules on the Treatment of Prisoners. The working group recommends to the government to allow independent monitoring of places of detention in the United States, and in this connection, consider inviting a special rapporteur on torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, and the working group on arbitrary detention. International human rights standards should be observed in the criminal justice system. We recommend the abolition of the death penalty throughout the United States. The working group calls upon the government to ensure that all states repeal laws that restrict the voting rights. In particular, it urges reinstatement of voting rights of persons convicted of felony who have completed their sentences. Targeted measures should be developed with the community to raise awareness and reduce crimes against LGBTQI community, in particular against transgendered women. The working group recommends improving reporting of violations involving the excessive use of force and extrajudicial killings by the police, and ensure that reported cases of excessive use of force are independently investigated, that alleged perpetrators are prosecuted and, if convicted, punished with appropriate sanctions, that investigations are reopened when new evidence becomes available, and that victims or their families are provided with remedy. The working group recommends to the government to step up its efforts to prevent excessive use of force by law enforcement officials by ensuring compliance with the 1990 Basic Principles on the Use of Force and Firearms by Law Enforcement Officials. Security policies in schools should be revisited. Policing in schools should be abolished. Misdemeanor laws should be repealed, such as the misdemeanor law in South Carolina, where school disturbance constitutes a misdemeanor. The use of restraint and seclusion in schools should be prohibited. Early counseling should be given to students with mental health issues. Special attention and protection must be given to students with autism, ADHD, and other similar disabilities. I'm going to add something here, too, that we must also consider the special needs of gifted children. Many children are diagnosed with liabilities, special needs on the negative side of the spectrum, also possess twice giftedness on the positive side. So they have high highs and low lows. I disagree. I digress. The use of restraint. We recommend the government develop guidelines on how to ensure school discipline policies and practices are in compliance with international human rights standards. Positive Behavior Intervention and Support, PBIS, and restorative practices in school discipline should be used for reducing disciplinary incidents and improving learning in schools. Males should be separated from females in detention. Younger prisoners should be separated from adults. Alternatives to imprisonment for youth, such as intervention and diversion, should be explored. The working group recommends that health policies and programs should place particular priority on access to quality and affordable health care, with targeted goals to reduce maternal mortality of African American women. Consistently, the school curriculum in each state should reflect appropriately the history of the slave trade. The Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, should study zero tolerance policies and its disparate impact on African American students. A task force should be created to specifically focus on realigning and re-engaging students who have been dismissed from educational institutions as part of a zero tolerance policy. The working group recommends upholding the right to adequate standards of living, including the right to food, right to water, and the right to adequate housing. The government should immediately halt the demolition of public housing without guaranteeing replacement units. All such activities must be undertaken only through prior and informed consent and participation of the communities affected. The working group urges the government to strengthen the implementation of Executive Order 12898, including through the allocation of adequate resources. The U.S. government should undertake a review of policies to improve protection and ensure environmental justice is provided. The working group encourages the government to undertake impact-oriented activities in the framework of the International Decade for People of African Descent, which is 2015 to 2024. This January 1, we entered the second year. Finally, the working group welcomes the cooperation and engagement with the international human rights system to combat racial discrimination. We hope that our report will support the government in this process, and we express our willingness to assist in this important endeavor. him.
Brother Michael, so, in the last few minutes that we have, as we have another program coming up at 9, what would you say? Is this, what's the question I'm looking for? What kind of impact do you see this having on racism in America in the future?
So I think it's a process, right? I mean, we've been at it for how many centuries now?
Right.
But I think, you know, when we look at, you know, critical race theory, when we look at, you know, how outside international pressures and the consistency, right? The fact that Fran Fanon's daughter was here and leading the group and is on the reparations committee in France, right? But those conversations are going on in many countries. That, you know, that begins to give us leverage, because you know the old trope, you know, it's not a pattern, it's an isolated incident. Well, apparently there's a whole lot of isolated incidents in
the conference
in
has been locked.
Okay, somebody's in the conference room, one of the moderators coming up, and she locked the conference, I don't know why. Let's unlock that conference.
The conference has been unlocked.
All right, please continue, Michael.
Yeah, so I think it's a process. I think, you know, the last point to connect with the International Decade for People of African Descent is absolutely critical. In our hemisphere alone, you know, we're a nation. We are 200 million people of African descent in the American Central and South American hemisphere. And when we speak with a voice, you know, we can start to build through our networks and our work some different outcomes. I mean, I think they're calling also for other treaties to be signed. I mean, you know, American exceptionalism, and yet we haven't signed. We're not up to date to or up to snuff on all our human rights treaties. We should be signing all of them,
right?
And then we should be complying with them with international law. But this stuff takes time, as you know. I think for us in civil society, though, mm-hmm. we have seen some change before through executive orders.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that this is Obama's last year, I know people have different thoughts on him, but to the extent that you know, an international community is calling for what we have already agreed to, stuff that we have signed, and calling us out, there are specific
for not implementing it
that we can try to push.
Okay, okay. So it gives us leverage, so to speak, to
yes.
to use here internally for our own. Okay, I got you. All right, you did a great job filling in, and I appreciate you informing us about this. I would even call it a historic event, because, you know, this is something that Malcolm X was calling for, you know, talking about taking a case to the UN and others as well. So
That's right. In fact, many of those who have been veterans a lot longer than I have said that this particular committee was a group was much more receptive than it had been in the past. And many folks call for reminding us that, you know, it was Paul Robeson that wanted to charge genocide. And I think Eleanor Roosevelt may have talked him out. But then they presented in Paris in 51. And that report has never been acknowledged sufficiently by the U.N.
Okay.
So we also charge genocide, but we realize that this is a process, and that you know, we got to stay in the venue and keep using the leverage. But I'm appreciative of the opportunity to share with you all and to be part of this work, U.S. Human Rights Network at Equity Matters. We promote equity in all policy. And so I just appreciate the opportunity to stand on the shoulders of those who've been doing this work for a lot longer than I do, and I will do my part in running the race with the baton.
Thank you again for hosting tonight.
Thanks much.
Oh, mercy, mercy me.